Hello, everybody, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. My name is Grant Podolko. I'm an editor on the website here at RFERL's headquarters in Prague, and I'll be your host. In this week's show, we have a lively discussion about 5 Days of War, a new film from Die Hard 2 director Rennie Harlan. The movie tries, but largely fails, to tell the real story of the brief 2008 war between Russia and Georgia, a conflict largely forgotten in the West. Andy Garcia stars as Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili.
My fellow citizens and world leaders, we are facing a massive attack by Russian forces who now control Skim Valley. We have called out to all our friends in the West and trust that you will not allow this aggression to continue.
Romanian music journalist Lucian Stefanescu introduces us to Kuresh Yagmai, an influential Iranian performer whose career was knocked off course by the Islamic Revolution of 1979. RFE writer-at-large Jamie Kirchick, who's just back from a reporting trip to Tripoli, talks about whether the National Transitional Council is up to the task of leading a post-Qaddafi Libya.
I think that they are as ready as one could be. I mean, if you look at the other kind of post-authoritarian situations in the Middle East, I mean, certainly more so than Iraq, more so than Tunisia, I would say, they've been preparing with a lot of external help provided by the international community.
And Daisy Sindelar checks in with Adnan Nevich, an 11-year-old Bosnian boy who was celebrated as the world's 6 billionth person back in 1999. There's been little to celebrate in his life since then.
My son was a guest of honor when a local pediatric department was opened 3 years ago, but I don't think we could even afford for him to be treated at this pediatric center in Sarajevo.
But first, 5 Days of War. That's the new movie by Die Hard 2 director Rennie Harlan that looks at the brief and, at least in the West, largely forgotten war between Russia and Georgia in August 2008 over the breakaway Georgian Republic of South Ossetia. It stars Andy Garcia as Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili and Rupert Friend as the crusading American journalist who risks his life to tell the world about atrocities committed by Russian soldiers during the fighting. And therein lies the problem. The $12 million film is being widely criticized as a piece of Georgian propaganda, casting Russia as the clear villain when the true origins of the war are still in dispute to this day. To discuss 5 Days of War, I'm joined in the studio by Salome Asatiani, a broadcaster with RFERL's Georgian service who's also no stranger to The Blender. Welcome back, Salome.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into it, I wanted to read a few reviews that have come out recently about 5 Days of War. The Washington Post, for example, calls it an overwrought drama that could hardly be said to aim for objectivity. Bloomberg says the phony Russian accents sound like bad imitations of Boris and Natasha, the Cold War villains in the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons.
Natasha, come out wherever you are.
Here I am, darling. I was just hanging up these new cobwebs.
And while the New York Times praises its viscerally stirring battle scenes, it calls the film's screenplay cliched, quote, a wallow in old-time Hollywood boilerplate, some of which you can't believe is being recycled yet again. So, Salome, what did you think of 5 Days of War?
Well, I would have to agree with the critics that this film is probably one of the most cliché-ridden film, if I can put it that way,
yes,
films that I've ever seen in my life. Now, for me personally, the fact that it is a biased movie or it has a political message, that wasn't so much of a problem because it was clear from the very outset that this was going to be a pro-Georgian film. After all, it was conceived by the Georgian government. The idea of this project was conceived by the Georgian government. So it was absolutely, it's no surprise that it is taking the Georgian side. It's trying to show the Georgian version of the events that led up to the war, or as Georgian officials would tell you, or Georgians in general, the truth, the way it's seen in Georgia, the Georgian version of the truth. Main problem with this film for me is that it cannot even succeed at being this. It's not, it could be classified as a propaganda film, but it is a bad propaganda film. And that was the saddest part, and also in a little bit of a, you know, tragicomical way. It's, as one critic wrote, I really like this crisp definition. It's really hard to understand what this film is trying to communicate and who are its primary audiences, to whom. It's the cliches is one problem, and another problem is that in terms of technicalities, the plot, the dynamic, the casting even, for me, is a big failure. Now, the director, the Renny Harlin, of course, is not exactly known for a nuanced or a subtle approach or even original filmmaking. He is the author of Die Hard and such.
I think Cutthroat Island as
yeah,
well.
The chewing gum kind of entertainment flicks. But allegedly he just, at this point, he wanted to change somehow his style or his the way he approached filmmaking. So this was the first project he embarked upon and the 5 days of August. The plot, of course.
Which is, just not to interrupt you, it's also called 5 Days of August. I think in the U.S. it's 5 Days of War.
Yeah,
so there's two titles.
Absolutely. The subject, of course, would have given him or any other director a chance to make a really great, intense drama. But old habits, as we know, are sometimes hard to break. So the film, this particular film, ended up what's most painful to me as just a member of the audience and as a Georgian viewer of this film is that the film reduces real life suffering and unspeakable horrors that really took place to very shallow, bombastic entertainment, and it is really sad.
You Americans, Saakashvili started this war. You understand? We are here just to protect our people in South Ossetia.
I could give a fuck who you think you're trying to protect. But I would love to know how shooting an old woman helps you to do it.
I'm only a soldier. I have my orders. Georgia already lost this war.
So, Salome, how has the film been received in Georgia itself?
Well, there was, of course, high. There was much anticipation and hype around the film, and even from the very early stages when it was being conceived and then when it was being filmed, because obviously it was being filmed on location. It was filmed in Tbilisi, in Gori. A lot of Georgian people participated in some of the scenes. And the premiere, as you probably know, was very pompous with most of the movie's stars, Andy Garcia together with Harleen arriving and none other than Sharon Stone also attending the and parading it on the red carpet. In the beginning, when even before the premiere took place in Tbilisi, the film was shown at the film market, I have to underline, film market of the Cannes Film Festival. And some officials, and especially pro-government TV channels, tried to portray it as a Cannes premiere of this film and big success. But some of the Georgian film critics were actually there present at the festival, and they wrote that this was not a Cannes premiere. This was shown at some hotel in a film market, and anyone can show anything as long as you pay for it. Now, there is this person, Kobana Opia, who is said to be the main financier of the movie, someone who bizarrely celebrated to be a successful businessman with interest in gold mines and at the same time an MP. Obviously, normally you can't be both. You have to be either one or another. But he is the main backer of this project, financial, but also, as he himself describes it in a conceptual way too. He was the one who conceived the project together with some other MPs. Now, he tried in the beginning, before the Georgian premiere, to actually, he actually said in one interview that anyone who dislikes the movie is enemy of Georgia. But that didn't play out very well. And of course, now most of the reviews I have seen, actually printed reviews in Georgian press, were negative about the film. But of course, the hype and the premiere and television propaganda was about that we finally, now about the opening, the film just recently opened in the United States, and that was also celebrated as a big success. But.
Well, you mentioned Andy Garcia. Why don't we hear a clip from the movie? Andy Garcia plays the Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili, and in this clip, I think you'll hear Andy Garcia really chewing up the scenery.
What's the news, Christopher? Any news from the Americans on our ceasefire proposal?
I was told that President Bush spoke to both Medvedev and Putin personally. They're not interested.
Putin left Beijing yesterday and said he was going to come here and command this personally. And he told Sarkozy that he will not quit until I'm hanged by my balls.
There is some good news. The EU ministers have finally agreed to an emergency meeting.
Oh, thank you, EU. An emergency meeting. Oh, let's bring cocktails, champagne, let's celebrate. Meetings, and more meetings. No more meetings. Every time some people sit at meetings, more of our people die.
So what did you think of Andy Garcia's portrayal of the Georgian president?
Well, and when I first found out that it was him who was going to play Saakashvili, I actually was thrilled because, for starters, I think the physical resemblance is really striking. They really look very much alike. But also, I'm a big fan. I was a big fan and I still am a big fan of Andy Garcia. I think he's one of my favorite, my personally, male Hollywood actors, I think. And I can never forget his kind and sad eyes in Hero, one of my favorite films by one of my favorite directors, Stephen Frears. He was wonderful in there. But unfortunately, in this film, he plainly overacts or misacts. His Saakashvili is a neurotic wreck in tears, unable to give out proper commands. He explodes. Of course, he's dealing with the biggest crisis in his presidency, obviously. But I think there is a bit of an overacting, and that also plays out in the moment when this Georgian general, who shows up several times in the movie as the rescuer, as a stereotypical rescuer, at a very critical moment, even disregards his orders. The order is given out to leave Gori and to retreat to Tbilisi, but he says, oh, I don't care what the orders are, and orders are given out by Saakashvili, obviously, the president. But somehow he's such a weak figure in this film that even this general doesn't really obey his commands. So that was also a little bit comical somehow.
What do you say?
They're abandoning the city.
We've got to get in there.
What do you want to do?
I will not run. I will not lose my country. I want the too many wars to keep Georgia free.
If it's possible, if we still have a couple of minutes, I would like to say, for me personally, going back to the Georgian film, the most painful scenes come at the very end when we have this sequence of real people, real Georgians who lost their family members at the hands of the militias and these mercenaries. And it's probably last like 3 to 4 or 5 minutes, not more. We see these people clutching the photos of their loved ones and just plainly telling us what happened, how the grandmother was killed, how the grandfather was hanged. And these scenes are almost unbearable to watch, of course, and for anybody. And for me, I'm not watching this from an objective position, obviously. I'm a Georgian and I remember the horrors that were happening back then. But these scenes, to me at least, also created a very awkward feeling, as if in these last moments, somehow it became even more clear that everything that came before that was just a mediocre entertainment, somehow manipulation, and that is a bit of a turning real life tragedies into glossy entertainment and big cars explosions and bullet ridden corpses that we see in slow motion, all these cliches, and then in the end finding like 3 minutes to quickly tell us, to show us these people whose lives have been ruined and who went through unspeakable tragedies, to make an entertainment or some kind of a visual entertainment out of their stories, to me was really repulsive, I would say.
Well, thank you very much, Salome. 5 Days of War is now in limited release in the United States and throughout Europe.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
In our monthly Ear to the Ground segment, Lucian Stefanescu introduces us to Iranian musician Kourash Yagmai, who endured a recording ban for 22 out of the past 32 years. A new album brings together some of the best of Yagmai's psychedelic rock from the 1970s. Here's Lucian.
Hello there, my name is Lucian Ștefănescu. Welcome to Ear to the Ground, the monthly musical section of RFURL's podcast, The Blender. On August 23rd, Now Again Records from Los Angeles released an album which could be labeled as the album of the month, or at least by those interested in fusion, world music and history. Kurosh Yagmaye, pre-revolution psychedelic rock from Iran, 1972-1979. Now Again Records claims Kurosh Yagmaye and his brothers Kamran and Kambiz were amongst the few inspired Iranian musicians determined to change Tehran's musical landscape in the late 60s and early 70s. The trio merged Western psychedelic rock and Iranian traditional music to create a sound unlike anything before them. But the Yagmaye's star on the rise was knocked off course by the Islamic Revolution. He has suffered a performance and recording ban for 22 out of the last 32 years. And while most pre-revolution musicians, including his brothers, fled Iran in 1979, Kurosh stayed in his country. We're listening now to the song Ghazal. هم دل گل خنده ها بود هم راز جنگل سبز و نمی پرنده ها بود تو آینه یه چشمه می دید مستی چشمه خماره دلش می خواست باشه دائم رنگ گل ها در کنار پیش بود سایه غریب میدی تو کمینش چه کسی. Atossa Azizi, music producer at Radio Farda, was 5 years old in 1979, but she told me she remembers very well what was the impact of Yagmaye's music in those days.
He was very famous during the 70s. This was the high time of Kurosh Yagmaye and his music. I remember very well that especially his biggest hit, Gole Yagh, which means ice flower, was a song that everybody could a little bit sing along. It was, of course, pity that after revolution, these artists were not allowed to continue their work.
For a number of years, but afterwards he was allowed, I think, from the early 1990s.
Yes, after Khomeini epoch, some artists came back and tried to work. I mean, I have heard that Kurosh Yagmaye was teaching playing guitar during the time. He has actually an album waiting for permission to be released for 5 years now, yes.
I think his music is actually not necessarily psychedelic rock, but it's sort of a sad ballad. And his texts, I've read some translations, are like poetry.
You know, if you come from the West culture, you're used to see rock music as a kind of protest music. And rock musicians are actually rebels. This is not the fact in Iran. It was actually the other way around. It was like back to the roots. Kurosh Yagmaye was a guy who wanted to cross over different music directions, music styles, like very old Iranian folklore music with rock style. He wanted to offer a more sophisticated kind of music, more ambitious, because the 70s especially, in West and in East, were a time of disco music, dance music, light music, easy to understand, easy to make. And he was going in other direction to offer a little bit more complicated, thoughtful music. I don't know why people are describing his music as, LSD music. It was not. It was very thoughtful and very deep.
Yes, but psychedelic music doesn't necessarily mean LSD music. That's a style which has a lot of things in common with introspection, with poetry, even without words. Coming back to the 70s, that was not only the disco period, it was the years of the psychedelic rock as we know it, and as actually Kuroshiak Mae did not copy, but very nicely emulated it.
Of course he did. It's a pity that he could not continue. I'm pretty sure his music was worth to be known also in an international scene, and he needed a little bit more time, which he didn't have.
I would like now to focus on this 1979 moment in music and in culture in Iran. This censorship that the Islamic Revolution put on this sort of music, isn't it against the tradition, actually? For me, it's a paradox, because the Islamic Revolution government say, we are the tradition. So isn't it sort of a contradiction here?
Of course it is, but they don't care about it. I guess this version of Islam they are talking about is against music. They say, we don't want music at all, but we tolerate some special parts of music. They did in the 80s tolerate pure traditional music with only traditional instruments. Still, if you were carrying a tar, which is a very traditional Iranian instrument, it could happen that they catch you and break your instrument on the street.
Atos Azizi, music producer at Radio Farda.
من میونه دو تو چشم خون قشنگه لونه کرده شب تو موهای سیاهت خونه کرده دو تو چشم خون سیاهت مثل شبهای منه سیاهی های دو چشمت مثل غمهای منه وقتی بغض از مژه هم پایین میاد
Goleyad, a song that opens the album Kurosh Yagmae, Pre-Revolution Psychedelic Rock from Iran 1972-1979, released on August 23rd. My name is Lucian Stefanescu. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned to The Blender.
باد میبره دو تا چشمام بارونه شبونه کرده بهار از دستای من پر زد و رفت
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rfrl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
That was the sound of the call to prayer in Tripoli on August 26th. The first Friday call to prayers in the Libyan capital in 42 years without Muammar Gaddafi at the helm. I'm here in the Blender studios with RFERL writer-at-large Jamie Kirchick, who just returned from a reporting trip to Tunisia and Libya. Welcome back to the Blender, Jamie.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your trip. What were some of the highlights for you?
Well, one of the highlights actually happened in Tunisia before I went to Libya, where I met a Libyan-born
exile who had spent 30 years living in the United States. And several years ago, he moved back to Libya to care for his sick mother. And I asked him, you know, do you miss having been in the U.S.? Do you wish that you were there now? And he said, no, I actually was really happy to be in Libya to see all this happening. He was too old to take part in the fighting, but he had left Libya a couple months into the civil war to go to neighboring Tunisia and to help care for the very large community of refugees who had been driven out of the country. And he was raising money for them, and he was helping feed them and clothe them. So that was one of the major highlights. And then certainly in Libya itself, I think seeing Green Square, which is now Martyrs Square, where Gaddafi would rally all of his quote-unquote supporters, seeing that completely empty and covered with anti-Gaddafi graffiti, I thought was just a really amazing moment, because this is this plaza you've seen on TV all the time, and to actually be there right. and see it yourself was pretty cool.
Now, Gaddafi's still on the run as we record this, and pro-Gaddafi forces are still putting up a fight in some areas of the country, but the National Transitional Council is being increasingly recognized as the legitimate representative of the Libyan people. Are the rebels prepared to lead the country? Where are things headed, do you think?
Well, I think you need to distinguish between the rebels and the National Transitional Council. The rebels are a bunch of kids. You know, some look to be 15, 16 right. years old, and young men carrying guns. Those are the rebels. The National Transitional Council, these are more sort of elder statesmen, if you will, professionals, doctors, lawyers, Libyan exiles. And they've been preparing for quite a long time. I mean, really since February, they sort of founded this, external government that's based in Dubai. And they've been based, and they've also had, obviously, office in Benghazi, which has been a liberated city for months now. So I think that they are as ready as one could be. I mean, if you look at the other kind of post-authoritarian situations in the Middle East, I mean, certainly more so than Iraq, more so than Tunisia, I would say, they've been preparing with a lot of external help provided by the international community. So I would say that that group of people is as prepared as they can be. The real challenge is going to be, again, dealing with these rebels, with these young men with guns.
And you mentioned Iraq just a few minutes ago. You don't see a connection between Libya and Iraq in terms of what happened in Iraq and their unpreparedness for the invasion and the subsequent post-invasion period?
I mean, I'm not an expert on either country, but as I understand it, in Libya you certainly do not have the kind of sectarian divides between Sunni and Shia and Kurd and all that as you do in Libya. There are, people talk about tribes and they talk about clans, and you have like a Berber minority, but they've been fully integrated into the rebel structure, if you will. So I just don't see the same sort of chaotic situation developing in Libya as we've unfortunately seen in Iraq.
Well, speaking of religion, while you were in Tripoli, you visited the Maulay Muhammad Mosque there. Tell me why that was significant for you.
Well, as you said before, this is the first call to prayer in 42 years, which without Gaddafi in power, and like most Arab dictators, most dictators really in general, in Islamic countries, he put a real sort of iron fist on the practice of Islam, in fear that it could one day represent a alternative power structure to his. We've seen that in Uzbekistan, in Turkmenistan, and in a lot of countries in our broadcast region. And Gaddafi was no different. And visiting this mosque, some of the people told me there were rumors that there were cameras in the mosque to monitor all the sermons that the imams would give. The imams in all the country's mosques had to be approved by the government. So when I visited this particular mosque, which is very famous, it's actually on the currency of the bills that they have there. They hadn't seen the imam in a week. This was a week after Tripoli fell, and the lead imam who would deliver the sermons every week had disappeared. They hadn't seen him. So I think it's obviously an amazing moment for the country, for its people, and it'll be very interesting to see what role Islam will play in the state.
Well, thank you very much, Jamie, for coming back to The Blender.
Thanks for having me.
And let's end things with a recording you made, Jamie, at a press conference in Tripoli of members of the National Transitional Council singing Libya's pre-Gaddafi anthem in celebration.
Libya, 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 Libya.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда.
Айче Радіо Европа.
Машал Радіо.
Азатить Радіо.
Азатицюн Кетаєм.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
In October, the Earth is expected to pass a dubious milestone, with the world's population due to pass the 7 billion mark. Population growth remains an urgent global concern, particularly for poor and developing nations where the increase has been the most dramatic. RFE's Balkan service recently visited the boy who became the world's 6th billionth person back in 1999. Despite his celebrated beginnings, Adnan Navich today lives in poverty, with little support from the outside world. RFE's Daisy Sindelar has the story.
Adnan Navich is a sturdy, good-natured 11-year-old living in the Bosnian town of Visoko, just outside the capital, Sarajevo. In many ways, Adnan is a lot like children everywhere in the world. He likes soccer and dogs and worries over his grades at school.
I have straight A's at school. I only have a B in English. My favorite subjects are sports, history, and geography. I have a huge responsibility to be a better student.
But Adnan is more than just an average schoolboy. He was also the baby who became the global symbol of a major population milestone nearly 12 years ago when he was named the world's 6 billionth person. Adnan was given the title after he was born in a Sarajevo hospital at 2 minutes after midnight on October 12, 1999. That was the day UN experts had dubbed D6B in preparation for the moment when the Earth's rapidly growing human population passed the historic threshold. Newspapers around the world featured pictures of a tightly swaddled Adnan, known as Baby 6 Billion, being held by his namesake, then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Annan expressed hope that the history-making birth of a Bosnian Muslim baby could help restore peace and religious tolerance in the Balkans after nearly a decade of war. Even now, Adnan enjoys a degree of celebrity. His mother, Fatima, says local officials and well-wishers still bring birthday cakes and presents to the family's apartment on October 12th.
They come every year to celebrate his birthday. They come from Sarajevo and Visoko. That day is special. The atmosphere makes it feel like he's really the 6 billionth inhabitant. And when we explain our situation, everyone is horrified. But only on that day, because the day after his birthday, our lives continue in the same old way.
That same old way is surviving on a monthly stipend of just $140 a month donated by the city of Sarajevo in honor of Adnan's special status. Fatima, a former textile worker, is out of a job. Her husband suffers from cancer, and he too is no longer able to work. Nearly all the money from Adnan's stipend now goes towards medical care for his ailing father. Adnan and his parents sleep in a single room in their tiny apartment, and the family cannot even afford to enroll Adnan in a local soccer league. Poring through an album of photographs and newspaper clippings about her son's famous beginnings, Fatima says she feels abandoned by both the Bosnian government and the international community. Dissolving into tears, she says her worst fear is that Adnan will become gravely ill and she will not be able to help him.
My son was a guest of honor when a local pediatric department was opened 3 years ago, but I don't think we could even afford for him to be treated at this pediatric center in Sarajevo. Thank God he's healthy. So I don't need anything for him. The only problem was that the doctors found a small hole in his heart.
Ironically, Adnan's plight reflects wider worries about the world's population growth. Experts say that the world is facing enormous challenges in feeding and housing its human inhabitants as birth rates and life expectancy continue to grow, particularly in developing nations. Researchers have already predicted baby 7 billion will be born in India in October 2011, right around the time that Adnan, baby 6 billion, will turn 12. But such global issues mean little at the moment to Adnan, who struggles with more immediate concerns. The thing I want most, he says, is some help for my father with his treatment, and then something for me. That's all.
That was Daisy Sindelar reporting on the difficult childhood of Adnan Navich, the world's 6 billionth person. The story is based on reporting by correspondent Tina Yalin Dizdar of RFE's Balkan Service. If you'd like to see a video of Adnan and his family, visit the multimedia section of our website at rferl.org. And that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you so much for turning on the blender. Until next week, this is Grant Padalko saying, take care, everybody. Reason.